I'll start with an autobiographical note from my very boring past. There's nothing worth recounting, but I do remember sitting in the sociology class in school and thinking, this is extremely boring. So no need to write any autobiography. It's all boring, nothing interesting. So very boring. Possibly there are more boring subjects. I think economics must be more boring. And probably accounting is even more boring than that. The only thing in accounting, after studying for years, sorry if there are any accountants here. No accountants? Okay. The only thing is in accounting, it can get exciting after studying all these years if you have to cook the books and take a bribe for doing so. So that might be a little bit exciting. Anyway, despite being profoundly boring and largely irrelevant to society, the sociologists, they do have some interesting things to say. Actually, these mundane scholars, many of them they're good scholars in the sense that they're good at studying things. It's just their whole attitude stinks. When you see these mundane scholars, they make a study of the Bhagavad Purana, and they may bring out some good points. You just have to filter it out from all the poison, that's all. A lot of poison. Anyway, their whole attitude is poisonous. Anyway, sociologists of religion. Instead of being religious, they become sociologists of religion. They study people like you. So they say that religious movements often, well, they generally start out as a reaction, or they often start out as a reaction to the materialism of society. And then after some time, they become institutionalized. They become materialistic. They start off with a small group of idealistic people, often headed by a charismatic leader. And then after some time, people get used to them, and they don't want to be so idealistic. And they merge into the broader society as part of it, instead of remaining as a rebellious group on the fringes of society, scorned by orthodox members of society. They make some adjustments and orthodox society accepts them. And then they become no longer a protest against materialistic society, but part of it. And then what happens is, after some time, some members of that group think, hey, we lost it. We're supposed to be non-materialistic. We're supposed to be idealistic. And they make a reform movement. And then again, for some time, they're all spiritually minded. And then the reform group also becomes compromised. And this is a cycle that goes on. And on. For instance, simplifying the whole situation, but we see that, well, the Protestant groups in the Christian religion, the word comes from protest. They protested against the materialism of the Papists, the Roman Catholic Church, and some sects of Protestantism were extremely anti-materialistic. So they didn't want anyone to have any enjoyment whatsoever. no one should enjoy anything, because I don't know exactly what their idea is. Maybe they want to share in the suffering of Christ. That's a common idea in Christianity, or at least it used to be, that we should share in the suffering of Christ rather than Krishna calling us to share in the enjoyment of God. They want to share in the suffering of God, which Prabhupada said was rascaldom. When one priest came to Prabhupada and said that we've understood that now Christianity means to share in the suffering of God, and Prabhupada said that's rascaldom, he immediately told him, using those words, that God doesn't suffer. That I also noted, was that just yesterday I was saying to you, after all these years I came to had this thought that whereas all over the world in Christianity they prominently display the icon of Jesus hanging on the cross, not in Protestantism actually, but they make a big thing about Jesus hanging on the cross with the crown of thorns and the suffering of Jesus, but actually in India they emphasize more like on the infant Jesus, and because I don't think Indian people could get off. They couldn't get enlivened by a God that's suffering. Doesn't seem to make any sense. It's not very attractive either. Indians like their gods to be enjoying. So there you go. Krishna's the supreme enjoyer. So they join in the suffering of God. So there were the Puritans in England who they would go around on Christmas Day and try to stop people having a festival because you're not supposed to be happy. And people, they would come and confiscate their Christmas puddings that they were eating and in this way be pure Christians. However, later in came the Protestant ethic, as it's called, that, well, if you're rich, that means that God likes you, right? So it's good to be rich. Work hard, make lots of money, be rich, and if you're poor, that means you're sinful. That was one strand of interpretation in Protestantism. That's because been very influential in the way the modern world is going today, because that became very prominent in America. So this rebellion against materialism and then again merging into materialism, I thought about this. What's that? I saw something. Anyway, it's like the hippie movement in which the Hare Krishna movement in the West started in the heyday of the hippie movement. Because when you say hippie movement, it was an unorganized movement without any official leaders of young people, mostly from middle class backgrounds, who had been born into, if not great wealth, but sufficient facilities for living plus more, who they rebelled against the grossly materialistic society of America in the 1960s. This was preceded by a smaller movement, the Beatniks, in the late 1950s, and then around, I guess, 64, 65, the hippie era began, in which it was anti-materialism, but not religious. And nowadays it's very common in America for people to say that, well, I'm spiritual but not religious. Self-defined spiritualism. So there was a whole movement. It was a protest against the Vietnam War. They didn't want to go to the war, and the boys didn't want to go and get killed, and The girls didn't want to lose their boyfriends. So there's a big protest against the Vietnam War. And then the whole way of life of going to college, getting a degree, working, making money, being a stereotyped, boring materialist. They protested against this by leaving the colleges, living in poverty, taking illegal drugs, having free sex without marriage, which was considered wrong by members of the Orthodox society. At that time, a whole new type of music was evolving, and eventually evolved into different kinds of music, which was all these, the music was very much linked with the protest against the war and the new way of thinking and free sex, and it was the songs were celebrating all these themes. So there was a whole, now that rock music, for want of a better term, because what is exactly rock music, it's difficult to define, is still going on today. But it's not the same as it was when it began, because it's no longer a protest. It's part of the modern society. It's become part of straightforward, or straight, as the straight society. And you find the golden oldies of rock music who were, they were symbols of a rebellious way of life. Then they have their pictures on the front page of Time magazine, and they get knighted by, if they're British, they get knighted by the Queen or given some award. If you're knighted, that means you're made into Sir. Instead of being Priya Govinda Das, you become Sir Priya Govinda Das. And that's considered a very high honor, that you're very much a respected member of Orthodox society. So the music is the same, but the message cannot be the same. And within rock music, not that I followed it over all these years, but I'm told that I've read that there are different strands of rock music and the whole social culture that goes with it that has tried to restore the original feeling with punk rock, which trying to make it, you know, a rebellious against society, but inevitably immediately got commercialized, because if it's successful, that means that people like it. You can sell it. If it catches on, it's like it's inescapable cycle. That if you make a protest movement and someone comes along and commercializes it, just like that symbol was there from the 1960s. People would wear it on their T-shirt, this symbol against nuclear power. It's a circle with a vertical line at the top, which around the center splits and forks. So they made it into stickers, T-shirts, and it's a sellable item. So what to do? So, okay, now for the Krishna consciousness. After all this sociological or pseudo-sociological analysis, let's talk about something Krishna conscious, which is why you came here. You didn't come here for a boring sociology class. So what does ISKCON, the Hare Krishna movement, do to avoid this cycle? How are we going to remain, or if we still are, idealistic? This movement started as an idealistic movement, with Srila Prabhupada would pass around a bowl or something at the meetings, and at his first meetings in New York City, and if they collected $10, they would think that's pretty good. Of course, the value of money was more then, but still, $10 would be equivalent to nowadays maybe, I don't know, $50 or $60, which really isn't that much to run a society on. But they didn't have much of a society. Devotees, they were sent by Srila Prabhupada from, they were in Canada, they went to Holland and then to England. So to enter England, they didn't need a visa. They're all American citizens. Yeah, they're all American citizens. So they didn't need a visa, but they had to show some money, that they had sufficient money to support themselves while they're in England. But they didn't have enough money to show. So they would, one couple would go with enough money to show to enter the country. Then they would send the money by money order or whatever. They'd wire the money to Amsterdam where the other couple was waiting. And then the next group would come. And then again they'd send it and the next group would come. So they were so low on money, they didn't have enough show money, as it's called. They had somehow got enough money to, they got cheap flight to Amsterdam. But very little money. And nowadays, we're told, for instance, I don't know if it's true or not, I guess it should be checkable if anyone wants to, that Bhaktivedanta Manor in London, where the devotees first went to preach, there with no money, has more than £1 million in the bank, in fixed deposits or whatever. So I've heard. Anyway, whether or not they have so much money, it's our movement is in England, or at least at Bhaktivedanta Manor, is not suffering for want of money. And our movement has also, in England and in other places, maybe in England more than in other places, become socially acceptable to the extent that members of our movement recently, it was said on Dandavats, they had a Diwali celebration at 10 Downing Street, which is the residence of the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. And they gave him a copy of Ramayana. I don't know why they didn't give him a Bhagavad Gita. Maybe they're afraid it says too many unacceptable things in there. So like that, our movement's become quite acceptable. Was it last time I was at the manor? There was a Hindu wedding going, very rich people, must have been, and some Rolls Royce car drove in, which Rolls Royce means, if you have a Rolls Royce car, that means the very peak of the social ladder. And no one fainted. It was, seems to be quite a normal thing for Rolls-Royce cars to come into the Bhaktivedanta Manor. So our movement has come a long way from being a motley collection of ex-hippies wearing odd socks. That was the normal thing, because you just throw all the clothes in for washing. Then they'd all come back, and you didn't have your old clothes. And we never had any time, because we'd rush out on Harinam Sankirtan. All the clothes are all mixed up, so how are you going to find the one sock which goes with the other sock? So you just grab any socks. So that was the way it was. You didn't even have your own kopins. It's pretty renounced, isn't it? You just grab some kopins, which have been washed with all the others. So we've come a long way. How to preserve the Krishna consciousness? Considering that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, Niskinchana anam bhagavad bhajanon mukhasya parang parang jagamisho bhavasagarasya. What is that? Vishayanam. What's that? Atai. Sandarshanam yat. Vishayanam atayoshitam cha ha hanta hanta visha bhakshanato piyasadhu. Well, this is specifically for renunciants, but even to see them, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, for someone who's a non-materialist, even to see the face of a materialist or a woman is worse than drinking poison. So how are we to preserve that spirit? Of course, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with being socially accepted. But if we are accepted by materialistic society and by adjusting our own principles, then we've become part of a sociological study of how we morphed back into the materialistic society. It may be subtle. The message, the words and the message may be the same, but the attitude is different. Just like in the rock songs that the rock singers still today play are the same ones that they played in the 1960s. It's the same songs, but now it's not a protest. It's just a song, that's all. It's maybe a wish of something that you used to believe in, but you don't really believe in it anymore because your values have changed. So he may speak the same things, but the intention may be different. And then the whole thing is lost if we're not actually serious about becoming non-materialistic. One cannot be materialistic and be a pure devotee of Krishna. You can be a mixed devotee, but not a pure devotee. And mixed devotee, what's the use of that? This Chaitanya Mahaprabhu compared Hiranya and Govardhan, the father and uncle of Raghunath Das Goswami, who were devotees, but they were materialistic. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu compared them to worms in stool. He said that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said this material world is like a ditch into which people pass stool, and your father and uncle are like worms in that stool. They were devotees, but they were materialistic. So, how to avoid this syndrome? In the Protestant religion in America, there is one group who have maintained exactly the same principles that they came to America with. They're called the Amish, and they don't use electricity. They grow their own food using horses, they don't use any machines that they don't make themselves. So they preserve the same lifestyle and dress and everything that they did in the 1700s, I believe. They've been going on for 300 years. So they're still doing whatever they used to do, largely. So one way to preserve what you're doing is to just get stuck in time and to become an anachronism within the broader society. And be irrelevant to the rest of society. That the rest of society may see you and maybe have some respect for that, but they're not going to take it up themselves. And also, they don't have that spirit to change others to be what they are. So that's one way of doing it, of preserving. The other way is by the process of protest within the protesting about the way the religious practice has been done and then making a separate movement and then that, or a movement within the movement, and then again that gets merged back into the materialistic whole, and then again someone has to come and put it back on course, and whoever wants to put it back on course will be, generally they'll be blamed by everyone else. What is the solution? Is there any way that we can keep ISKCON on track exactly? Well, there are Prabhupada's books. And the fact that Prabhupada wanted them distributed very widely, that is the hope, actually. Because it's practically inevitable that to some extent, at least, our movement will become stodgy, bureaucratic, institutionalized, which isn't, institutionalism isn't in and of itself necessarily a bad thing. I mean, Srila Prabhupada wanted that there be rules and regulations, that there has to be some organization. But when the organization exists for the sake of existing and the maintaining the buildings and the social setup becomes more important than becoming mad with love of Krishna, then we are institutionalized in the derogatory sense of the term. So what is the solution? Prabhupada's books and the example of Srila Prabhupada and any great devotees who are following in the footsteps or devotees before that, that the spirit in Srila Prabhupada's books is so clearly anti-materialistic that anyone who reads that, unless they're trained prior to reading them to filter out Prabhupada, which sometimes happens, they cannot fail to be struck by the intense spiritual call, come out from this materialistic society. Look for that verse, Kamasya Nendriya Pritir. That purport is just, I mean, the verse itself and the purport are just 1, 2, 10. You're a good number cruncher, as they say. You know the numbers. I'm not so good on numbers of verses. You got it? Kamasya Nendriya Pritir. Labho jiveta yavata. Or do you want to read it? Life's desires. Let's. Labho jiveta yavata. Jivasya tatva jignyasa. Narto yascheha karma bihi. Translation. Life's desires should never be directed towards sense gratification. One should desire only a healthy life or self-preservation, since a human being is meant for inquiry about the absolute truth. Nothing else should be the goal of one's works. And then Prabhupada's purport is devastating. Anyone who wants to be materialistic, kindly run out of the room as fast as you can. Or if you happen to be at the other side of that television, whatever it is, webcam, you better immediately switch it off or run away as fast as you can. Okay, Prabhupada's purport. The completely bewildered material civilization. Ah, tremendous. I mean, so many people all over the world realize that there's something wrong with society, and Prabhupada just immediately smashes. They're always thinking what they can do to... We just have to adjust it a little bit like this or like that. Just make a new 5-year plan or do something to help the whales, save the whale or something. Do something to make this world into heaven. Srila Prabhupada starts off, the completely bewildered material civilization is wrongly directed toward the fulfillment of desires in sense gratification. Completely hits the nail right on the head. Exactly got the point, which we couldn't all see because we're all in the darkness of ignorance. And Srila Prabhupada, with the shalaka, the instrument of giving actual knowledge, just reveals all our bewilderment. In such civilization, in all spheres of life, the ultimate end is sense gratification. In politics, social service, you see, people are serving others, helping society. Altruism, again, these are all good things. Altruism, philanthropy, and ultimately in religion, or even in salvation. Religion is differentiated here from salvation. Religion means going to church and praying, give us this day our daily bread, or going to Sai Baba and saying, cure my backache, etc. And salvation means to want to get free from the material world and merge into the oneness for sense gratification. The very same tint of sense gratification is ever increasingly predominant. In the political field, the leaders of men fight with one another to fulfill their personal sense gratification. Remember, this was written in the early 1960s when people around the world still believed that politicians actually had the interest of the voters in at heart. They actually believed that John F. Kennedy was a good man and Indira Gandhi was... She probably believed it herself, that she's doing good for the country. So the voters are... The leaders of men fight with one another to fulfill their personal sense gratification. The voters adore the so-called leaders only when they promise sense gratification. As soon as the voters are dissatisfied in their own sense gratification, they dethrone the leaders. The leaders must always disappoint the voters by not satisfying their senses. The same is applicable in all other fields. No one is serious about the problems of life. Even those who are on the path of salvation desire to become one with the absolute truth and desire to commit spiritual suicide for sense gratification. But the Bhagavatam says that one should not live for sense gratification. One should satisfy the senses only in so much as required for self-preservation and not for sense gratification. So I'm just reading this as a sample of the kind of message that we get in Srila Prabhupada's books, which will always give hope. That although it's practically inevitable that at least some members of the Krishna Conscious Movement will usurp its facilities and the positions within it for sense gratification and adjust the philosophy somewhat for sense gratification, that people who read Srila Prabhupada's books without getting it reinterpreted for them, they will be able to understand what is Krishna consciousness, what Prabhupada came to give us. Srila Prabhupada didn't come to start another Hindu sect or a new religion. But Srila Prabhupada came to give knowledge of what every one of us needs to know to become completely fulfilled in all respects, which means to know that we are eternal servants of Krishna. We have nothing to do with this. We have no relationship with this material world. And anything, any doctrine which promotes living in this material, making much effort to live comfortably in this material world or improve the material condition, is cheating. Of course, Srila Prabhupada wasn't, as Krishna isn't, totally oblivious to the material condition, but he gave, Srila Prabhupada gave the solution for living in this material world, the same solution that Krishna gave, which is Varnashram Dharma, following that. So, ISKCON's social effort should be on those lines. Then we know we're following Prabhupada. The books, that Prabhupada gave us these books, that is the hope. It would be overly, and practically we're seeing it is overly idealistic to think that our movement, Srila Prabhupada's movement, cannot become infected with materialism. But at the same time, we do have Srila Prabhupada's books, which give the clear message of what we're doing, what we're supposed to be doing. And the Christian reform movements also, they must have got inspiration from the life of Jesus as it's recorded in the Bible. He wasn't a materialistic person. He was renounced from this world, speaking against materialism, living in a non-materialistic way, in a spiritual manner, speaking of God. And he was able to inspire people. Later, his inspiration got turned into churches. But people came out of that and said, hey, we want to be like Jesus. We don't want to be like the Pope or the priest. We want to be like Jesus. So we have the books of Srila Prabhupada, which give a... with all due respect to Jesus, they give a much more clear message than the one that was purported to have been spoken by Jesus. We're not sure exactly what he spoke. Give us a very clear message. And we have the ideal of Srila Prabhupada's life, which was not materialistic, but not foolishly idealistic also. Srila Prabhupada, he wasn't so non-worldly that he would, for instance, go everywhere barefoot, or like Mahatma Gandhi, go around in just some little cloth or something like that. He didn't want our movement to become so aloof from the world that we can't interact with it. So exactly where to draw the line, it may be difficult to say. A devotee might appear to be materialistic, but actually they've adopted some level of interaction with the material society with the express purpose of changing it. That may be there also. So it may be difficult to judge what others are doing exactly. But, yeah, there's also the program that Prabhupada gave us that also helps to distinguish. And so there are also lines by which we can see if people, they don't rise early in the morning, they don't chant 16 rounds, they don't follow the four regulated principles, then we can understand they're off track. So there are certain things that are required for everyone to do if they are to be bona fide followers of Srila Prabhupada. Anyway, it's a very big question, and those who hear me regularly can understand that it's a question which very much concerns me, because I talk about it quite a lot. I'm very concerned that our movement is becoming affected in various ways by consolidation with the materialistic society and compromising our message and our lifestyle and our activities and so many things. But the real hope is if devotees read Prabhupada's books and try to understand them in the spirit that Srila Prabhupada himself composed them. Because we do also see sometimes devotees read Srila Prabhupada's books, but they're already, the devotees they meet before they read them condition them to read them in a certain way, so they don't get the message as it is. For instance, they may say, well, this certain things Prabhupada said, they're not meant for us, or he said that 40 years ago, or you shouldn't repeat that because it's too heavy, or in various ways, politely, innocuously, edit the what Prabhupada's saying. So we kind of put it in the back of our minds, although Prabhupada's putting it right out in front for the whole world to see. Anyway, there's a few thoughts on that. Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Any comments, questions? Yes.
Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that evam parampara praptam imam raja shayogidu, and then sakale in evamata yoga nasta parantapa. So what can be the major cause of yoga nasta?
What is the major cause of yoga nashta, the path of yoga being spoiled? Just in the previous verse, Krishna said, what did he say in the previous verse? Imam vivasvite yogam proktavana ham avyayam. So he says this yoga is avyaya, it's indestructible. And in the next verse he says, yoga nashta, it's become destroyed. So this means that the knowledge itself is not destructible, but its proper understanding in human society has become destroyed. So what are the major cause of that? Well, people mess it up. It's the message itself doesn't change, but it gets, instead of being properly represented, it gets re-presented. Changed. So parampara, the parampara started. First of all, Vivasvan, then Vivasvat. I saw a house yesterday or something. The name was there, Vivasvat. I just noted that. Yeah, did you ever notice that in your going around Belgaum? Some house, just some house, there's so many thousands of houses. We were going through the old part of the city, so must have been an old house. The house had the name on it, in big letters, Vivasvat. So from Manu to Ikshvaku, and the knowledge was received, but in Krishna says, Sakale Neha Mahata, by the mighty force of time, or Mahata could also here mean in long course of time. So time is the factor which destroys, decays, causes decay. So Krishna's time causes everything to decay, and then he comes himself again and restores everything. Grasishnu Prabhavishnu cha. He causes destruction and then again renewal. Anything else?
We feel like when you're preaching Krishna consciousness now, so though the message may be diluted, still people take to some extent, like...
Yes.
And then...
Yes.
And later...
Yes.
Later, the leaders, they can reform them. Like, people who are atheistic, if they start believing in reincarnation or concepts like that, it becomes more easier for us to preach. People going away from... the Vedic culture, if they start accepting the principles of Vedic culture, basics, may not be outrightly the Varnashrama which Prabhupada wanted, but still some concepts of Vedic culture.
Yes, all right. So the proposition is that we should preach in a compromised way because people can more readily accept it, and in this way they're brought to some level, and then later we can bring them to a better level. Neha bhakrama nasho si pratyavayana vidyate swapamapyasya dharmasya trayate mahato bayat. Yes, very good idea. We should have Hare Krishna youth beauty contest. Then all the... Didn't start that yet? Didn't think of that one. See, I know, it's a good suggestion, right? Can have the young ladies' fashion show with short skirts, and then it'll attract many young men will come who would not otherwise come. It's a very good idea. You see? And all the girls can have tilak on. Of course, they won't be looking at their faces. Yeah, they already started it. Someone did it already. I wouldn't be surprised. I'm saying it's a joke, but anything and everything's possible. Yeah, let's give a watered-down version and more will come. So this is the perennial tension between quantity and quality. And you could say that Srila Prabhupada, in some ways, he did reduce the quality in order to make it available. He didn't insist on that everyone fast on Ekadashi fully. He said you can take greens and beans. There are many things that Srila Prabhupada didn't insist on. He got the basic message across. So how far do we go? How much water can we add in the milk? With the people who don't want to take milk, you put more water in and tell them, actually, it's not milk, it's water. And then with the idea of gradually giving them, when it becomes like 1% milk, and then they'll agree to take it, and then you make it 2%, 3%, 4%, 5%. So the idea is that you kind of trick them into doing something which they think is materialistic, and then gradually you bring them in. Well, the problem with that is, again, you can ask a sociologist of religion, if you can. I don't think there are any in India. All the students of Hinduism are all in the West, or of any. In India, there's only, I think there's only going to be two subjects, engineering and medicine, and then there won't be any other colleges. No, they have now colleges for fashion design. They have that also. But things like sociology, hardly studied in India at all. So, what happens when you water it down so much that you may say that people, well, they'll accept it at one level and then gradually you can bring them up. But practically we see they don't. And we're seeing that within our ISKCON today, that we have on various levels watered it down with the idea of bringing people up. But then when you speak the actual philosophy the Prabhupada said, then from within the movement there's so much protest. So you're bringing people in, but can you bring them up? If by doing the things that Prabhupada told us not to do, you can bring more people in, how are you going to tell people to do the things that Prabhupada told us to do? And how are you going to take them off the things that Prabhupada told us not to do when you yourself are promoting those things? So, better to do the right thing from the beginning. And say, hey, look, and speak the philosophy. Another problem with this is that you can bring people in by not speaking the philosophy. But then you get, or speaking something else. So if we're always saying, well, come in, you'll have a great time, you can enjoy it, it's great fun, and there are prizes, and you talk in a materialistic way, but then you yourself get so used to saying that, and you're so much conditioned by the idea that we have to just say the things that people like to hear, that we ourselves, we no longer believe the things that we're supposed to say. And when we have to tell people that sense gratification is for pigs, we ourselves don't believe it. We ourselves, by creating that kind of atmosphere of attracted materialistic people, we ourselves become materialistic, maybe in a subtle way. And we can't say what people need to hear. So there's a very great danger in making Krishna consciousness so much available that there's no standards. And we can't speak the clear philosophy as it is. That's why we need sannyasis. Because sannyasis are supposed to live in a different way and be clearly speaking the absolute truth without compromise. And the in Varnashram society, well, that's the Varnashram solution, actually, is to have sannyasis who are respected by society. It's understood that grihasthas in general may be somewhat materialistic, but they also accept the sannyasis who say what they have to hear, so that at some point they can make the change. Brahmanas, not only sannyasis, brahmanas, they may be married, but they don't live a materialistic life. They bring forth children as a duty. So, yeah, the brahmanas are required in society. So Prabhupada wanted ISKCON primarily to the core members to be brahmanas. When the core members become vaishyas or some kind of perverted kshatriyas, then we're in trouble. Or if they're brahmanas but they become compromised themselves by the kshatriya, vaishya, shudra, chandala types, then we lose it. That's why brahmana has to be, he has his, by being sworn to poverty, he's independent. Then he doesn't have to do what some king wants him to do for maintaining the king's image. The brahmana can say to the king, you're in maya, you're not doing your duty properly. He can say that because he has nothing to fear. Even his own life he doesn't care for. He doesn't mind. If the king doesn't give him any money, he doesn't care. He's not compromised. So that's the solution. Prabhupada's books are there, and those who live according to the books without any compromise, they are the hope. Hare Krishna.